Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through underwriting by Joan Geller Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. In the past decade, numerous grassroots organizations have become popular in the U.S. and around the world as the baby boomer generation begins to struggle with aging and the end-of-life movement, such as movements such as Death Cafe, the National Village Movement, Death Doula Practice, Social Model Hospice Homes, Home Funerals, and Green Burials, just to mention a few, are gaining momentum across the country as consumers begin to seek out options and choices for their later years. My guest today is Dr. Karen Wyatt. Dr. Karen Wyatt lives in Silverthorne, Colorado, and is a family physician in training, who spent many years of her medical career caring for hospice patients. She's the author of the book, What Really Matters, Seven Lessons for Living from the Stories of the Dying. She also hosts a popular online interview series, End of Life University, where she interviews experts who work in all aspects of the end of life arena. She is widely regarded as a thought leader and a mover and shaker in the effort to transform the way we care about our dying in the United States. In addition, she's valued for her spiritual wisdom and application of spiritual principles to illness and healthcare, and has been called America's Spiritual MD. This show today has been pre-recorded, and you can find Dr. Wyatt at www.karenwyattmd.com. Dr. Wyatt, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, I appreciate that I'm able to talk with you about just this whole arena that you've been working on for so many years, and also the fact that you're coming to San Luis Obispo, and we can hear some of your thoughts in person and also hear you talk more about your book as well.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be coming to your community and to meet people and have a chance to share some thoughts and ideas with all of you. And I thank you for that opportunity.
Oh, our pleasure. With regard to your background in family practice medicine, how did you kind of move into hospice medicine? Was that something that pulled you in? Was it something that happened because of the kinds of patients that you were seeing?
It actually happened because of a personal tragedy in our family. My father died of suicide, and I had a very difficult time coping with my grief after his death. And about 3 years into it, I wasn't really getting better, wasn't finding my way out of that dark place and functioning well. And one day I got the idea that maybe I need to try volunteering for hospice. And I thought, if I just immerse myself in death and dying and sadness, I'll figure out some way through my own grief. And I started volunteering for our local hospice. As soon as I made my first home visit to a patient, I suddenly knew that that's really where I belonged. It just like opened my heart so much, and I felt like this is actually the place I've been meant to be throughout my medical career. I'm home now, and this is where I should be. So ultimately, I started doing hospice full time and gave up family practice altogether for several years.
Now, you spent a lot of time when you were practicing medicine and delivering home care medicine, correct, to your hospice patients?
Yes. I worked for a home hospice agency. We didn't have an inpatient unit, so I made home visits to every one of our patients at that time.
And during that time, that really kind of spurred you to write. You've written more than one book. You've written actually quite a few about this topic, but the most recent, I think, is What Really Matters, The Seven Lessons for Living from the Stories of Dying.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
What about that? What was it that compelled you to write about the patients that you were seeing?
Well, as I mentioned, when I started out in hospice, I was still really kind of lost in my own grief in the beginning. And so I had quite a journey through that hospice work of working through my own grief process. But what really struck me is the patients that I was sitting with and talking to and listening to, so many of them had so much wisdom to share, and many of them were so at peace, even though they were dying. They were so had such equanimity, and then a lot of really deep perspective on life and what it means and what really matters in life. And I learned so much from them, and I really found it was the patients who actually helped me. I felt like I was the student, and they were my teachers. And it was their wisdom that helped me through my grief, and then to go on to even learn deeper spiritual messages from them that they were grappling with at the end of life. So ultimately, it just inspired me. I felt like these are lessons and stories that should be shared with everyone, because not very many people get a chance to have that experience of sitting at the bedside of a dying person.
No, absolutely not. And I think a lot of people are afraid of that.
Yes, very much so, which was another reason I felt like, you know, so many of the encounters I had with patients and their families, in spite of the fact that they were sad because the patient was dying, there was so much love and deep joy within those families. And I felt like I need to share these positive moments with people who have no idea that this is how dying can be. And people who are so afraid and avoiding and denying the subject of death really need to start to hear some positive stories to help them get more comfortable.
I had written an article that you had written in, one of the many articles actually that you've written, and this one was posted, I believe, in the Huffington Post, about 6 steps to rise above your fear of death. And I was intrigued by when you were introing this, you had talked about how we just naturally try to avoid death. It's something that's kind of inherent in all of us. And you had written, death represents an ultimate unknown, a territory in which we have no experience and no control. And so it feeds us to feel fear. But it turns out that this avoidance of death doesn't serve us well in the end. What do you find in the practices of working with the dying that you bring to it, or that other people who are working in this field really need to bring to individuals who are dying and their families?
Well, the most important thing that I came to understand, and if you know, I started in hospice with absolutely no experience or mm-hmm. knowledge about hospice
yeah.
care at all. So I started out a complete novice and having no idea, like, what am I doing here? When I made my first home visit to a patient, I was terrified because I thought, I hope they don't ask me any questions because I don't know anything. But what I discovered was that what patients needed the most from me was my presence. And at that time, I've been a meditator and done yoga for years and years. And so I do have a calm aura about me and, you know, an air of calmness. And it was simply that I could go into the household, even where there was anxiety or fear or some sort of upset, and just be present and just sit with people. And by listening and bringing a peaceful atmosphere to them, I found it to be the most helpful thing I could do. And so it didn't matter if I knew everything or could answer every question. It was that I wasn't afraid to be there and to see what was happening and to sit with them
now,
through it.
As a physician, do you find that is a, such a different practice from kind of what has become the natural practice of medicine for many physicians here in our country?
Yes, I think especially in the last decade or so, where doctors are under such a time crunch. You know, they're especially doctors in primary care. Their visits are so short, and there's so many different issues they're supposed to cover, and they're focused on going through checklists and checking off boxes, that it's very hard to be present in that way and just listen to patients. So I think it's something that's missing to a large degree in medical practice these days.
And do you have any ideas about what a fix for that is?
Well, I did, you know, at the end of my career before I retired, I went back to family practice for a while. So I had that experience again of going back to primary care where I didn't have the luxury of being in a patient's home where I could sit at their bedside. I went back to that same pressure of you have to see four patients an hour and you have to move them through. But what I found for myself is that it was my calmness that made the difference in the visit. And if I just would take a deep breath before I walked in the room, and I would try to leave behind everything that had happened up to that point, every other patient I'd seen, every question I'd been asked, every stress that was going on in the office, leave it all behind and think, this is the moment I am here with this patient, and I am going to connect with them, and I'm going to hear what they need. And so taking that one moment before I walked in the room made all the difference. I could sit down then with the patient and usually zero in right away just by being willing to hear what the patient had to say. I could zero in right away on what it was they really needed from me that day. And so even though we had a short visit, I could still accomplish a lot during that time and help the patient feel heard and listened to and comforted.
How often was what you were hearing another test is what they needed, or, you know, how much of it was just human focus versus technology?
Well, for me, this is totally my bias.
Of course.
About medicine. But for me, most of what I heard was people who were frightened by some symptom that they had, some belief that they had about their health, by something they'd read or something
right.
Someone else had told them. And they needed to talk about what they feared was wrong so that we could put that right out in the open. And many times I found when we led with that, and I got to hear first, like, what are you thinking is going on? I'd hear first what they were afraid of. We could get past that and look more logically and rationally at what their symptoms might mean, and it really eliminated, we didn't end up having to do nearly as many tests just for reassurance, because once they told someone what they were worried about and we talked it through, they didn't need as much reassurance. They felt more comfortable right away. And I would always design a game plan, like, we're starting with the simplest, easiest things we can do right now, and we'll work our way up if we need to. We'll add more tests and more studies if we need to. But let's start at the most logical point right now, and we'll work our way through the list of things we could potentially order if we have to go that far. But very often we didn't. Very often it was fairly easy to uncover what was really going on.
They did surveys here in California talking with individuals about what kind of conversations they have with their healthcare providers. And a surprisingly small number of those patients said that they talked about end-of-life issues or even dying issues or fear of dying, that if those discussions came up, they tended to come up around a life-limiting illness as opposed to a fear. Is that something that you think in the medical environment it's beginning to be a little bit more known as this is something to expand the conversation around?
I think it's beginning to, and there are doctors out there who are concerned. Especially, I've met a lot of emergency room doctors lately who are very aware that we need to have this conversation about death and dying, because they're the ones seeing, seeing a 95-year-old brought in from a nursing home and having to do a resuscitation on that patient, because no one ever asked the patient what their wishes are. So I think doctors are beginning to wake up to it a little bit. My hope is that as baby boomer doctors my age, we're all now facing the deaths of our own parents. And I think that may open our own eyes. And, Dr. Atul Gawande, who wrote Being Mortal, that whole book came from his experience with his father at the end of life. And so I think other doctors in a similar situation are going to wake up and say, whoa, wait a minute. As they watch their loved ones go through this process, they're suddenly going to awaken to it and think, this should be different than it is. We need to practice differently.
Absolutely. If you've just joined us on Central Coast Voices here on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, my guest is Dr. Karen Wyatt, author of the book What Really Matters, Seven Lessons for Living from the Stories of the Dying. She also hosts End of Life University, an online interview series that features conversations with thought leaders and experts about all aspects of end of life. She's written articles about end of life related issues featured in USA Today, Publishers Weekly, Huffington Post, Shift Magazine, Light of Consciousness Journal, and the Denver Post, and numerous medical journals. Today's show is pre-recorded, Dr. Wyatt, we talked a moment ago about Dr. Atul Gawande. He is somebody that has written about his experience. He is also somebody that you've got coming up on one of the end-of-life universities, a death expo that you have coming up online, correct?
I wanted him to be my guest. Okay. I tried to get him, but he's just way too busy.
Okay.
So I wasn't able to bring him on, but I'm hoping for that on a future date when his schedule clears up a little bit.
Okay, and tell me a little bit about Death Expo. What is that?
Well, Death Expo it's a four-day kind of very intense online event. It's like a virtual conference in a way. And there will be three speakers each day who will be talking about different subjects within the end of life. I have Dr. Ira Byock.
I meant Ira Byock.
That's who you were thinking. Yeah, Ira Byock. He'll be talking about hospice and palliative care and some of the advances being made in palliative care, but also in encouraging doctors to talk more about end-of-life issues. And Stephen Jenkinson, I think he has been in San Luis Obispo in the past.
He has. He was here in March of this year and actually will be returning in March of next year.
Ah, that's wonderful. So yes, I'll have an interview with him about his latest book, Die Wise. He's another very interesting person to listen to. And a number of people, I have Kate Kalanick, who's from the Green Burial Council, so she'll be talking about green burial and what that consists of and how cemeteries and funeral homes can be certified to do green burials.
So the End of Life University, it's an online talk a little bit about what that is. It's an online podcast.
I created it as an online platform for these interviews. I do, all year long, I do two interviews a month that are posted online kind of every other week. A new interview gets posted, and the people who subscribe get a notification whenever a new interview comes up that they can listen to for free. And the Death Expo is an offshoot of that, where it's more concentrated, where there are three interviews a day for 4 days. So a lot more speakers all at once from Thursday through Sunday that people can listen to over a shorter amount of time.
That's terrific. And you're coming here to San Luis Obispo. In fact, you'll be here the day that this show airs on November 12th. And you're going to be doing a free community presentation that's being hosted by Hospice of San Luis Obispo and the San Luis Obispo Coalition for Compassionate Care. And can you talk a little bit about your presentation here?
Yes, and that's the one in the evening, is
yes.
that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I wanted to make sure. yes, I'll be talking a bit about what really matters in the book and the lessons that I learned from patients about what really matters and how we can learn from the dying process what we need to know to help us live a better life, to live a more meaningful and fuller life, and also live with less fear in life, because I think fear kind of counteracts the love and joy that we would like to be experiencing. And so when we can help people reduce fear, there's much more capacity for that love and joy. So that's what I intended to focus on for everyone to kind of hear some of those lessons.
The impact that the end-of-life university has, do you find that more people are starting to listen from their own homes in their own time, just to broaden their awareness about the different kinds of things that you're presenting to them?
Yes, it's been interesting. It's really gaining a lot of momentum. And more I'm finding a lot of people who have newly become interested in the end of life, who've never really worked in that arena before, but some who suddenly feel called, like, I think I need to be a hospice volunteer, or somehow I need to get involved in this movement. And so they're coming to End of Life University and listening to interviews to get educated a bit, because they, you know, they're getting a lot of the background information that they need to help them. And then the other thing that's happening is that it's becoming a bit of a hub, so that, I did an interview with a woman who created an event in her community about death and dying. Mm-hmm. And she talked all about how she put that event together and created it. She got calls from people all across the country who wanted to do a similar event. They ended up networking with her, and she helped them put together events in their country, in their communities. So I'm finding that it's a great platform for people networking. So people listen and get ideas and end up connecting with someone else and inviting them to come and work with them or teach together. So it seems as though there are a lot of us out there who are working in the end of life and who've been in silos, as they say, for a long time without having any idea how many other people are doing the work. And End of Life University has become a way for us to all network and connect together.
Do you find, since you've been doing this for the past 25 plus years, do you find that those conversations are easier now to have? Do you find that people are more maybe more attentive to the end of life discussion, or maybe even looking at their own lives in terms of it coming to an end at some point?
Very much so, because in the past, it would be extremely rare for me even to meet a nurse or someone else in the, you know, a social worker or someone else in the medical field who would say, I feel drawn to hospice. I almost never met anyone who would say that. And now it seems like everywhere I go, people are telling me, oh, lately I've just been thinking, like, I need to become a volunteer. I need to get involved somehow. What can I do? So definitely, I think there's this awakening and acceptance of the end of life that's happening.
Do you think there's this desire at some point to get closer to death, to become more comfortable with it?
I think so. I do think that's part of what's fueling it, is that people are recognizing that, you know, this is a reality. It is going to happen, and people are not comfortable being in denial anymore and pushing it aside. They're much more open and willing to just talk about it and confront it.
Now, you wrote an article, again, I think this one was for the Huffington Post also, about social model hospice. And that's something that is kind of a new approach here in this country. It's certainly been used in other countries. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, the model, I really love this model. The model is to provide a residence for patients at the end of life who really need a place to live more than they need medical care. And that's true of a lot of our hospice patients actually don't require very complex medical care other than, you know, pain medication and something mm-hmm. for anxiety. But some of them can't stay at home because either their home isn't appropriate for them to be there or they don't have a 24/7 caregiving available to them at home. So a social model hospice provides a residence where those patients can come and live. It becomes their home where they stay, and they have 24/7 non-medical caregiving, like aides who are mm-hmm. there to help with care. And they have hospice care also from mobile hospice providers who come in to visit them in the social model home as if they were visiting the patient in their own home. So they still get hospice care, but the social model hospice provides them with the housing that they need. And that actually, it didn't exist where I practiced hospice, but it would have solved a number of problems we had for patients who just didn't have the caregiver support available that they needed.
And where do they end up going, Karen, now?
If they don't have the
right.
social model hospice, well, some could go to an inpatient hospice if that's available, but that's actually over-treatment in many ways
right.
because inpatient hospices, they're there to provide extensive medical care when a mm-hmm. patient really needs that, needs 24/7 nursing care available. Some probably go to nursing homes,
mm-hmm.
And some may even end up in the hospital for the last week or so of their life because there's no other place to go. And I know in my own community we've had a couple of patients who ended up dying in the hospital, which is not where they wanted to be, but they didn't have enough caregiver support and had no other place to go.
There was recently an article that I read that was talking about the increase in Alzheimer's, and it was a comparison of the cost of Alzheimer's care to patients who end up dying as a result of cancer or congestive heart failure or heart disease. And the difference in the cost, because it's not covered by insurance, was phenomenal. First, because some patients have illnesses that are very prolonged. They're life-limiting, but they take a long time. Secondly, the requirements for round-the-clock care are just so extreme that it can't be provided at home. But they're just, like you're saying, there's really no alternatives. Is there anything that you're aware of outside of something like a model of a social model detox that is happening to try and address some of these issues?
Well, I know that there are some specialized Alzheimer's facilities happening, and I've heard of a few models out of these. There are what are they called again? The greenhouse project, greenhouse homes, I think.
I'm not familiar with that.
They're smaller, like a small version of a nursing home with maybe 10 patients, and it's a much more home-like environment with a large living room and a big kitchen and one big table where everyone sits around the same table. And they're less expensive than a nursing home to build and manage and more manageable for the staff than a huge, like, 100-bed nursing home might be, but provide the same thing, housing and support and care 24/7 for the patients within them. So that's something new on the horizon that I've been hearing about lately. Just attempts to find different types of creative housing for these individuals where they can get the care that they need, but that's at a little bit less expensive level.
Yeah. We find, I'm sure you see that where you are in Colorado too, that families are really distant from one another in terms of location. You know, we live in a community that sometimes the retired adults are here, but the children are other places in the world or in the U.S. And so the ability to move in with family requires sometimes a relocation from community to do that. So it's a tough situation.
It really is, and I'm a little concerned about the future because I've been reading that baby boomers, a much higher percentage of baby boomers have chosen not to have children.
Right.
And also chosen not to get married either. And so there will be an even larger number of older adults at some point in the future who don't have a lot of family caregivers available to them to help with care if it's needed.
Yeah, absolutely. You're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio, 90.1 San Luis Obispo, 91.7 Salinas de Paso Robles, 95.1 Lompoc, 90.9 Santa Ynez, 89.9 Santa Barbara, and worldwide on the web at kcbx.org. My guest today is Dr. Karen Wyatt, and Dr. Wyatt has stated that she believes that contemplating and actually preparing for the end of life can be key to creating a more joyful and meaningful life. In her book, What Really Matters, Seven Lessons for Living from Stories of the Dying, Dr. Wyatt shares stories of many patients she's cared for while they were dying and the transformative lessons they learned about what really matters in life. Lessons such as love, forgiveness, and making the most of the present moment. And Dr. White, can you talk a little bit more about what really matters? When did you write this book?
I wrote it in 2010, and that it actually, it took me a total of 12 years. I started writing it 12 years earlier.
So was it kind of a journal?
Yes, during my hospice years, I was having such profound experience with patients, and I actually started journaling during those years every day, which I still do. I've kept it up ever since then. So I started journaling about what I was experiencing because I was meeting such amazing patients and really doing a lot of growth myself, inner growth, as I said, you know, working through my own grief over my dad's death. And so I started keeping a journal, writing about those experiences. I even wrote some of the patient stories at that time. But it wasn't until 12 years later that I put all of it together into the book, What Really Matters. So that was 5 years ago that I wrote it.
Is there a story that comes to mind is just really standing out for you in terms of an individual or an individual lesson that really came through?
Well, a brief one is just a patient who actually inspired the title of the book, who was a man who was, he was extremely wealthy. He had accumulated a lot of wealth through his work, very, very successful in his work in the financial industry. He owned a huge home, had several cars, really had every material possession money could buy, but he lived alone. He was divorced from his wife many, many years in the past, and estranged from his son. And we took care of him as he was dying, and our staff ended up having to help. You know, he had money, so he could pay for caregivers to come in and take care of him. But as I sat with him and he looked around his house at all of his wealth and his material possessions, and he just said to me, you know, I only just now figured out that none of this is important. And he said, I only just now got it. What really matters in life is love. And he said, love is the thing that I shut out of my life. I sent it away and shut it out so that I could focus on money and material possessions. And he said, I wish that I could tell every person out there to stop and think about love, because at the end of your life, that is what you're going to recognize is the most important thing. And so him saying, this is what really matters, that phrase, what really matters, stuck with me. And also his reminder that, oh, people need to think about love and make that their priority instead of money and possessions. It inspired me later to think, you know, he can't share this story and he can't share this wisdom that he learned at the end of life, but I could be a voice for him and share his story with others. So that was the kind of the deep inspiration within me that made me think, someday I will write this. I will write a book that I can share with other people.
Did you find that that was a theme that you heard frequently from some patients, that there was this feeling that they were focused kind of in the wrong direction?
Yes, I did hear that quite often. And I saw patients kind of scrambling in some ways at the end of life, like forgiveness was the other issue a lot of patients dealt with, and recognizing, wow, I've been harboring all this anger and resentment for years and years and years, and now I don't want that. I don't want to take that with me when I die, so I have to work through it and forgive people and let go of it. That was very profound for me because it made me realize I'm going to start right now working on forgiveness. I don't want to wait until the end. My list is too long, so I need to get started right away.
You wrote an article about what dignity really means at the end of life. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I've been involved in a couple of different discussions where I heard people, I heard some people saying, death is horrible. There's no dignity when people die gradually and slowly. Other people saying, no, every death is dignified. And so I actually thought, well, wait a minute. What does dignity mean in the first place? So I'm a former Latin student. I took Latin all through high school. So I always go back to my Latin, and I looked it up to see what the word dignitas means, which was the Latin root for dignity. And it means worth or value. And so what struck me is that the message is that dignity is how we help our patients have dignity by valuing them and by honoring their worth and helping them know their own worth and know that they are valued and their presence is valuable to us. And I found that dignity was too often being equated with, whether the patient could take care of their bathroom needs by themselves or not. Too often it was equated with that when, in my mind, it was really how do we interact with the patient and treat the patient so that the patient knows that they have value and worth. That's what dignity is. And so that's what prompted me to write that article, to remind people not to get lost in the term and what it might mean, but to focus on treating every patient as valuable.
I think your point about the word dignity, and that somehow there's this this idea that dying itself lacks dignity, is kind of a sad statement.
Yes, that's what I felt. I didn't want that distinction to be made that there are only certain types of death that have dignity, because I think dignity is what we bring to the dying to process, and every dying person has beauty and tremendous value and tremendous worth, and when we view them in that way, we help them experience their own dignity in that moment.
And as a hospice physician, what did you see more often as kind of guided need for guidance for the family that you kind of reached out and helped with, because the idea of dignity comes to mind for me too. It's hard when people, I think, are struggling with the loss of someone or facing the loss of someone and not trying to cut ties from that while they're dying. And yet at the same time, to do that, that seems undignified. You know, that person loses their place as being a human being and being here. Do you understand what I'm asking here?
Yes, I think what I saw most often, and I got a chance to experience it myself when I took care of my own mom 2 years ago while she was dying, is that families sometimes can get lost within their own pain and their own grief, and they start focusing on all the details of, did we give the medication at the right time? Did we change the sheets? Did we do this? Did we do that? And start focusing on the work that they're doing for the patient and forget about the need to be present, which is what I was describing I learned as a doctor. It's the presence
exactly
that matters. And even if the medication's late, or even if you forgot to change the sheets that day, or, you know, even if some of those physical things don't happen the way we think they should, or that matters less than simply being present. And what I would try to help families recognize is that this is a beautiful, precious experience that you are about to have with your loved one, and these are the last moments you will have with them. And not everyone gets to experience this. Not everyone gets this opportunity. So make sure that you spend quiet time sitting with your loved one, holding their hand, or just being present in the room. Make sure you don't lose sight of those moments and get caught up in how hectic it is to be providing the care. Make sure you stop and allow for stillness and quiet time and simply be present. And then, you know, be available to listen if your loved one wants to say something, or just to observe them. And that, you know, I mean, the times I counseled people to do that, I sometimes wondered, is that really possible? Am I suggesting to people to do something
right.
that's too hard to do? But I did get to experience it myself, being a caregiver, and I had to remind myself of my own advice and my own wisdom in that process.
You wrote about a butterfly principle and transformation and growth through failure. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it came to me one day. I got to visit a butterfly pavilion and was looking at the, you know, they had a whole rack full of cocoons, or the chrysalises of the butterflies, and I started thinking about the life cycle of the butterfly and how the caterpillar has to experience destruction in some ways for the butterfly to be born. And as I reflected on that and my work experience, my life experience, the things that I've been through, I thought of how many times I have resisted going into the cocoon or into the chrysalis stage, where the caterpillar loses itself in a way and dissolves away to allow something new to be born, and how many times I had resisted that, or I had viewed that as a failure instead of recognizing that it was really just a precursor to something new that would be coming down the road. So for me, it was a kind of a profound metaphor for me to look at for myself, and the times when I judged myself for something not going right and falling apart, and recognizing, but if I were a caterpillar, I would just be in the chrysalis right now, waiting for the butterfly to emerge, and that's beautiful and that's wonderful. So anyway, that metaphor was really helpful for me to figure out how to just hold on a little bit longer and wait for the butterfly.
Something positive to come out of something that didn't feel so positive.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, when you were talking about really the nurturing, the caring, the forgiveness, the being kind to ourselves. And we were talking about families and how families need to remain connected and dignity when it's about a human being, and what dignity means. And we circled back to where we started this conversation, which really is, you know, how it was for a lot of the patients that you were seeing when you first started practicing hospice care without a clue of what hospice care was, except that you got it, that it's caring for another human being. When we as individuals aren't privileged to have a physician who really has the kind of approach that you do, that can sit down and take that moment of silence and focus, is there something that we can do as the patients to try and create that moment?
I think it's helpful as a patient if you've done a lot of thinking for yourself about what you would like to have come from the visit with the doctor, so that you prepare yourself and even think ahead about what do I most want the doctor to hear when I go there? What do I most need to say? Because in many office visits, I've seen patients get a little bit lost. The doctor tends to take over and start asking lots and lots of questions, which are mostly geared toward physical symptoms. Do you have this? Do you have that? How about this? And I think it's helpful if the patient has already figured out, I really want to ask the doctor about this. I really want to talk about this, and either leads with it or finds a way to say, I need you to hear something that I need you to hear me right now, and kind of almost interrupt the doctor, or at least find a way to get that through. But many times I found patients come in too afraid, and they don't have any idea what they're really there for, or what it really is. They're just afraid, and they're looking for reassurance. Then the doctor can just take over, and the visit tends to go in possibly a different direction than the patient really needs.
Is it helpful for us to acknowledge that we're afraid of something creating our dying or leading to our death, rather than just ignoring it or pretending like it's not there? I mean, is it helpful to bring that forward, or does it make it worse?
I think it's very helpful, because I think as soon as we talk about it, anything that we've talked about has less fear than it does when we keep it locked up in our minds and we kind of ruminate over and over again about it. We tend to exaggerate the fear if we think about it too much. But once we've talked about it and brought it out in the open, it's easier to look at and easier to analyze and understand.
In the End of Life University, how long have you been doing End of Life University?
For 2 years now.
Okay. And is there a presentation or something that happened that really stands out for you that was either really surprising or something that really kind of shifted your thinking that was brought up?
I guess one of the first things that I learned about that I hadn't even known existed before was the idea of a home funeral. And that was a whole movement that was going on that I'd never even heard of until I interviewed someone about it, who was a death midwife who helped people do prepare the patient's body at home and do home funerals. And at that time, it was not long after my own mom had died, and I suddenly realized, oh my goodness, that is what I wish I could have done for my mom. That would have been so perfect. And when mom died, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't even know it was a possibility. And so that for me was an eye-opener, and I felt like I really want other people to have heard about this, even maybe not having the funeral itself at home, but preparing the body of the loved one at home and keeping them at home for a while after death, instead of having them taken away right away.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people don't understand that they could do that. Now, obviously, we're not talking about keeping a body for months like you read about in the in the newspaper, but we're really talking about a reasonable amount of time and just allowing that experience to complete.
Because I remember after my mom died, it felt a bit traumatic for me after going through this like profound process of her dying with her in her bed, in her house, and being with her, to suddenly have her taken away,
right,
and for the house to be empty. It felt traumatic, and it felt like it happened way too soon. Mm-hmm. I wasn't ready for it. And so so hearing about that idea later, like, oh, if I had known, I could have kept her there longer. I could have bathed her myself and dressed her, and that would have been so powerful and so beautiful for me to have done that. So I was excited to share that information with other people who might benefit from it.
Now, on the podcast that you have, how long are those available, Karen?
After I do an interview, it's available for, say, the next 3 days. I do the interviews on Thursdays, and they're available usually through Sunday. A lot of times, actually, longer, because I forget. I forget to take them down. So they're available through, you know, for a whole weekend afterwards for people to have time if they want to listen to a particular episode. And I do have this, I sell an access pass which someone can buy, and then they can get the whole archives of all of the interviews that they can download and listen to at any time.
And in order for someone to find out more information about that, what's the website that they would go to?
They can go to eoluniversity.com. So it stands for end of life, but eoluniversity.com is the website. And there's a little sign-up form there, and it's free. If people sign up, all that means is they'll start getting an email every other week that will tell them about the upcoming interview, who I'm interviewing, what we'll be talking about, and then how to call in and listen, or how to find the replay of it to listen.
And there, you've done some interesting interviews. I've listened to a number of them, including one that you did with the founder of the Death Cafes.
Yes, with John Underwood from London. That was, very fascinating to hear him talk about starting Death Cafe. And
mm-hmm. How his mother used to make the cakes. Yes.
Yes.
Yes, great.
And he said in the very first Death Cafe, he planned a lot of activities for people to do, and when it was over with, his mother said, just let them talk.
Talk, yeah.
Don't do your activities, just let people talk. And that's where he recognized, like, oh, you know, it's better when there's nothing planned and people just sit together and talk.
So, and they just want to do something. We have about 5 minutes left, and I wanted to... also, note that you do have a Facebook page as well that people can go to, and you do regular posts on that with, and those do link to your articles as well when those are published, correct?
Yes, and I have a couple of Facebook pages. One is for End of Life University, mm-hmm. and that always has articles and interesting things I find about the end of life, death and dying, and grief, and I post the upcoming interviews on that page. And I have a page, Karen Wyatt, MD, that's kind of more about my my other blogs and writing and speaking events are posted on that page.
And then going back to speaking events, you are speaking on November 12th here in San Luis Obispo. And you're going to be talking at the Embassy Suites Hotel from 6 to 7:30 with a book signing to follow that. It is no charge to the public. And to register for that, individuals can go to Eventbrite and look up Dr. Karen Wyatt, or call Hospice of San Luis Obispo County, Hospice SLO, at 544-2266. And then I also noted you've got podcasts on iTunes.
Yes, I started going through some of the old interviews, you know, from the beginning of End of Life University and just posting them as podcasts on iTunes so they'd be available and searchable just for other people who might stumble across them, people who listen to podcasts regularly who might never have heard of End of Life University, you know, to give them an opportunity to maybe start to listen and get interested.
And those, again, are free. So yes. You can go to those on iTunes, and they can just either put in Kieran Wyatt, MD, or End of Life University, or I think those would probably be the best ways to find you.
Yeah,
right?
Those are the best ways. The podcasts are great because you can listen to them on your iPhone through a podcast app when you're in the car or traveling. Or, you know, it's just it's kind of nice to have them there. So I'll keep adding. I'm trying to add a new one every couple of weeks so that there's always something different and new to listen to there.
And Green Burials, you have a podcast on Green Burials as well. That's something that's come up around the two county areas here as something that individuals are really looking at, trying to minimize their footprint after death. And so that's something that you had a good podcast on that as well, if someone is interested.
Yes, and there will be Kate Kalanick from the Green Burial Council will be part of Death Expo, and so that'll be really interesting to hear her talk about that as well.
And again, I want to remind that Death Expo is a four-day seminar with three speakers each day, three different topics. Is this November 19th through the 22nd?
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
And that's available online to register for that, and it's free to attend. How do they register?
So they can go to back to eoluniversity.com, and that they'll find out about Death Expo there, or they can also just enter deathexpo.com and they'll get to that same place. So either one.
Okay. And the books for Dying Really Matters, Seven Lessons for Living from the Stories of the Dying, those are available on Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm. What Really Matters?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I'll have those available at the talk on November 12th, too. So we'll have books there for people to purchase and get autographs.
Okay, fantastic. I really appreciate you joining me. I want to thank Dr. Kieran Wyatt for joining me today. You can find Dr. Wyatt at www.eoluniversity.com. Central Coast Voices is sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities and the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. Your suggestions for future show topics are always welcome. Please send them to voices@kcbx.org. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and thank you for joining me on Central Coast Voices.